Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
Good morning, Fred. This is Greg.
Hey, Greg. We were chatting, and it was one of the times, I do this all the time with Kurt, but it's rare that you and we talk about a handful of things, and then we say, oh, let's hit record, and then we start. This one, he was like, oh, look this up. This is, and I'm like, wait, that make good stuff in the, so this is one of those cases like, oh, wait a sec, let me hit record. Sorry about that, but it's part of the show. And for longtime listeners, they know that we don't have a script. We don't, some people tend to have more organized thoughts and others don't. But I think part of what makes the show work, and I've heard from a number of people that it's engaging. I think it's because it's a real discussion. So today, Greg, what sparked your comments a few minutes ago to catch our audience up is, I ran into, or got comments from one of our listeners, and was talking about using MTBF was kind of the thing she's trying to get replaced to use reliability as a key metric for reliability related performance and how it's performing in the field and stuff like that. And the management team is that you can add it to the dashboard, but you can't replace it. We want MTBF. And she's trying to make the argument that MTBF is pretty much a faulty measure and it will lead to bad decisions. And here's the consequences of some of those, that kind of stuff. But it leads to the bigger question is, if folks are asking for what's going on in an organization, they have measures and metrics and ideas they're looking to track or look for trends or look for deviations or changes or whatever. What's the element? Where is the system breakdown that they allow either faulty data or skewed data or tampered data to influence those measures, those metrics? And then that leads to bad decisions. And so I just see it as a big risk if you don't pay attention to, and maybe that's just the engineer in me. I don't know.
Oh boy, where do we start, Fred? So, I'll just make a little joke, but it's a truthful joke. As we get older, most of us focus on one thing, and your focus lately has been MTBF. And I make a couple jokes about that. You react, right? I have to scrape you off the ceiling.
Yeah, I got a soapbox right here if you want me to get up
there. Yeah, I know you do. I like it. My clients like it, but you don't. And, you're on a mission. You're on a vision, right?
It's become a campaign.
Yes, it has.
Yeah, so it's... But anyway, it's not just that metric. I've seen it with other bad measures. I had one organization, I asked, how do you track your field failures and how's that happening? And they said, well, we get, say, 25 returns in a month. Let's say in January, we got 25 returns. And I says, okay, so how do you calculate the rate? And he says, well, it's too much work to look up the serial numbers and which month did those come from and do all the this other stuff. So we divide it by how many units we shipped out that month. So in January, they shipped 2,000 units and they got 25 back in exactly the same month. Now the 25 they're shipping out mostly never had a chance to even be unpacked or failed. And do you ship the exact same number of units every month? And they said, no. He says, you realize that you're just chasing phantoms in that data set. That's not a rational measure. And they were a bit upset about that. So I said, right, let's do the math. Let's just simulate this a little bit and see what you're doing here. And it still took a bunch of effort to get them to move off of it. They really liked that metric because it was easy. It was totally meaningless in all kinds of ways, but that's what they wanted to use to run their business. I'm like, oh my God, okay. But it's that's what leads to my, what's their responsibility to get it right?
Well, first of all, Fred, you know, my one host, my pony, my soapbox is risk. Mm-hmm. Yours is MTBFs. That's great. Remember, what you see depends upon where you sit. The team who's basically got one metric or KPI, it works for them, but it might not work for others in the organization, either up or across the organization. So we started this conversation about KPIs versus OKRs.
Yeah, I didn't know what OKRs are, so I had to look it up.
And yeah. So
objectives and key results, which on the surface makes it look pretty rational.
It's rational, but it's very painful.
Oh, that's why I never heard of it.
Yeah. Well, so the basic idea about OKRs is the organization comes up with a vision, mission, goals, objectives, mm-hmm. and those objectives are basically cascaded down the organization. An objective for a business unit becomes an objective for a VP. VP's objectives become directors, and right on down the organization. Okay.
So to make sure I understand it, it's like the objective is to be, you know, lead, you know, market share leader in the U.S. market by 5 years from now. Would be an objective, that kind of level?
An objective would be in 5 years, our market share will increase by 50% using, you know, and then there would be key results. That would be, that would take that objective and quantify it.
Okay. So it might be, that's where strategy stuff comes into it, saying, well, here's how we know if the strategy is working.
That's right. And the working piece is the key results, so the OKR.
Okay.
So basically, you take business results or individual results, like you're my boss, you give me some objectives, right? And I put key results right next, or metrics, right? Or something that I have to reach that's measurable right next to those objectives. And those cascade up and they cascade down and across the organization. Now, it's good in terms of management, but for the individual, here's the problem. If management comes up with the objectives and the OKRs, they can be unreachable. So the way the game is done, and it is a game, is they come up with the objectives. Emily, you're my boss. You come up with my objectives, mm-hmm. and I come up with the key results. And then we negotiate back and forth to make sure that we're both on the same page.
And then we have 5 or 10 objectives, and then we have 25 key results, and then we have time to do nothing.
Well, normally it's about 3 key objectives and about maybe 7-8 key results. So it should be doable. That's the important thing.
Should be.
That's the operative word, should be. That's right. Yeah.
And I imagine the stories of sales, you know, I've heard, I've never worked in corporate sales, but I've heard plenty of them have, you know, targets or objectives of how many sales dollars they got to bring in by end of quarter and so on. And the market just, you know, like we have a depression or a pullback in the market or some disturbance to the supply chains or maybe like a worldwide pandemic, something like that. You know, it's like, and then you still get held to the objectives. Otherwise, you know, it's like.
The objectives stay the same, but mm-hmm. the results, because of market variability,
should change. I've never heard that from sales guys that they get their chain, it gets changed. I've heard them grumble about it. they want me to sell this that nobody's got any money and we don't have any steel for him to build it anyway. And blah, blah, blah. And you're like, okay, whatever. I'm glad I'm not in sales. But it's supposed to be flexible given circumstances, I imagine.
Yeah. And that's the basic idea. The KPIs, key performance indicators, can be very mushy and wishy-washy. The idea is to take KPIs, key performance indicators, and make them measurable, track progress, and basically sort of individually, what do you want to call it, tailored, you know?
Yeah. And then, I've heard about those. And then I think somebody made a lot of money by writing the balance scorecard saying, well, if you have a KPI that pushes on this wire, you can game it. And I run into that where the procurement organization has a KPI to reduce cost of goods bought to make our products, the materials to make our product, without the balancing measure of what's the impact of field failures, for example, or scrap in the mill in the process due to faulty or poor materials. Once they get the balancing objective, then it's which one gets enforced. It's still a game. I find the KPIs have some issues with them. It's hard to do.
And that's the reason they invented, or, you know, somebody invented the idea of OKRs.
Okay.
To eliminate the gaming, have managers basically, I mean, for example, you could say, I'm going to eliminate, if you're in procurement or supply chain, you could say, mm-hmm. eliminate 10% of your suppliers. Okay, which ones do you eliminate? Are you going to eliminate the key single source ones or the, you know, commodity?
Yeah, the commodity ones, yeah. All right, yeah. In either case, I always find the measure of saying, you know, reduce by 10% or cut this, or it's not always, the ones I support are the ones that are thought through and explained. This is why we're doing this. You know, that having 15 different suppliers for commodities means we have the multiplier by 15 of the number of inventory items in our system, and different storage parts and incoming and transportation changes and stuff like that. If somebody says we need to whittle that down to say our three or four most robust suppliers for these commodity items. Okay, I get that, because it has a financial effect and little to no consequence to the product we're producing. But if they just carte blanche, like I've heard in procurement organizations, is we need to do a across the board 10% reduction in how much money we're spending for materials, independent of inflation, which has always galled me, and independent of, oh, it'll be the same, no problem. And that's famous last words. It's like, watch this, hold my beer, watch this.
Well, that's where folks game the system, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, basically what happens then is, you know, you get mutual destruction, you know.
what's a senior manager to do? Or if I'm advising somebody and saying they finally figure out that reliability is important, or they get that, but they realize that the way it's being monitored, measured, or communicated needs to be improved. You know, how do you get a system in there that actually works for the whole organization? That, and so objectives and key results, one of the things you mentioned is it's not always easy to do. So I still don't, maybe I don't understand it well enough yet.
Well, here's one of my, this has been a pet peeve of mine for years. Engineers don't like confrontation. They don't, you know, many, yeah. I mean, this
show
is
me the formula, you know, how much does it
show me the formula, yeah. I'll give you a result. No, yeah, yeah, exactly. And is the result right? Is it answering the right question? Is it basically going to help the organization or team? And what happens is, I mean, I hate to say this, but, you know, I'm one of them. Many engineers are introspected and introverted and socially inept. As a matter of fact, there's a YouTube group called The Socially Inepts. Funny.
Enrico and I just were talking about it. We just recorded earlier today. And you can be a brilliant engineer. If you can't communicate it, then you really have a hard process ahead of you. If you see a change that needs to be made, or you have a proposal or something like that, that's communication skills. I think and we agreed that it's really not taught in engineering schools how to communicate your work. So that's an epidemic across the engineering fields of all kinds. But that we use measures and metrics, and we're monitoring different, you know, key results, for example, in order to create some visibility to a complex organization. And where I look at it as the risk is that, and it might be that engineer in me, when I set up a measure or a mm-hmm. metric, or I'm going to do an experiment and measure something, I really want to make sure that that measurement is giving me something that's useful. If the measurement error is very large, I might as well just pick a number out of the sky, you know, because the measurement system's not giving me anything realistic to what's actually being measured. because the measurement error can be huge in some cases, it's worse than a guess. And I imagine things like field reliability is squishy because not every customer tells you their product failed. Not every customer puts your product into service. You know, so it's fuzzy around the edges. And I imagine more business-related stuff, if it's not tracked by dollars in the bank, it gets squishier all the time. So it's hard to make a measurement. And where do you draw the line on using, I call it squishy, but faulty or inaccurate large measurement error in, say, key results or KPIs or metrics or whatever, versus how valuable they are? Because that's the part of me goes, yeah, it's really bad. There are better ways. It's got an investment to get the better way. Is it worth it? And that's where I get pushback from senior managers going, I like the way we do it, which I don't think is well thought out kind of response.
A lot of it is knee jerk. A lot of it is self-protected. So again, I go back to that expression. What you see depends on where you sit. Mm-hmm. The engineer, reliability engineer, wants to give a number, right? Whatever the number is. Gives it to a manager, senior manager, director. When it falls on the VP, that's when your perspective changes. Because if you've got very high field failures and they're impacting the quarterly results or the yearly results, mm-hmm. they have to be reportable. It's called materiality failures.
Right.
And then I have to disclose it. I have to basically fix it. And by the way, as an officer of the organization, an executive VP, it's incumbent upon me to basically take care of it. That's one of the fiduciaries for mm-hmm. a senior officer. You see a problem, it's a high risk, it's material, I got to fix it.
Well, why does that lead to I don't want to know?
Because you have the defense of, what do they call it? Of
plausible deniability.
Plausible deniability.
Yeah. Is that a way to run a business? I mean, and I understand that they're getting like 57 different things they wish they didn't know every day, but something that really is material to an organization. One of the things I track, and I get, it's a newsletter and it's free. It's called Warranty Week. I think it's warrantyweek.com. And they have an email list that sends out, weekly email. And what it does is it goes through the financial statements from various public companies from around the world. And it lists their accrual for warranty and their warranty spend. And then they've been tracking it now for close to 20 years. And so you can see different patterns and trends and so on and in those results and get an idea how your industry overall is reporting it, not necessarily what they're actually doing. And it's time after time after time, you see a big blip in a company, which makes their newsletter pretty often, is that all of a sudden they discovered this problem that's been going on for 2 years and now they have to report it. And it's not like it wasn't there 2 years ago. Now they have to report it.
That's exactly right. It's called disclosure. And in the 10-Ks, 10-Qs, which are the SEC filings, mm-hmm. One third of them now are risk-based. But just think, pull up almost apples, you know, yearly filings, financial filings, so mm-hmm. financial statement. One third of it is basically risk-based because they have to report these things.
Well, it's whether it's trade barriers or it's wars in different regions or supply chain disruptions. I don't think anybody could predict the big ship that blocked the Panama, the Suez Canal.
Yeah, the Evergreen ship. But again, field failures, I'm going back to that thing because that's mm-hmm. what you brought up. If you got field failures, at what point, what's the threshold that we need to worry about that?
Yeah.
One in a million? Is that one in 10? Or is it the number of deaths that you have, right?
Well, yeah. No, I think the safety ones, at least my point of view, is the safety ones. Some organizations approach that very aggressively. There's one house fire or serious near miss, And they very actively have a plan to get ahead of that and solve it. Whereas others, which have then get involved with the ones I learned about because I was a expert witness in the cases, mm-hmm. is they knew full well this was a problem and they just kept selling it hand over fist and denied, delayed everything they could that it wasn't a problem. And it was like, you know, when it becomes a safety issue and you are killing people, then you just, that is bad business. And fortunately, the company I'm thinking about is two of them that did this. They're both out of business. But the idea from an engineer's point of view is like the ignition key thing. The culture in the organization was, well, it's not a big deal. And we're not going to test it too much. And one engineer said, no, this is a big deal. We needed, and it just got run over. It, part of the defense at the time is, well, they had lots and lots of issues and other things that had higher priority and more people, you know, concerned, agreed that it was a higher priority. So they just let this ignition thing go out. But it's one of those things that it's a, I know it's not easy to, what is the right place to say this is not right or not. When I was at Hewlett Packard, it was, warranty was a big deal. And it was monitored multiple ways. And pretty much anything that signaled about a 0.5% change in a particular product line's warranty problem was very aggressively approached. And that was predicted 0.5% change. And we didn't wait for it to actually occur. And so part of the training that we had and did and paid attention to is, well, how do you predict your maintenance, your reliability performance and make it plausible and double check it against your history and do stuff like that? And it, some parts of the organization paid very, very close attention to it, including senior management, whereas others completely ignored it. Where it became important is the CEO said, one of the most important things for our corporation is to be consistent with our forecast, profitability and financials and stuff like that. We see the next year and the next quarter, we're going to be XYZ, setting expectations. And we weren't. And she was saying we need to be more consistent, you know, more steady in our performance. And so we looked into why there was so much variation in the individual divisions. We had, it was all reported corporate-wide, but there was a lot of chatter in the individual variability within the divisions. And when we put that up on a Pareto for the leading reasons for the amount of variation that was caused, it was missing warranty. Either your product was better than expected, so you had too much profit, or you had a poorer product than expected and it had too much warranty expense taken away from profit. And it was orders of magnitude bigger effect on our financials overall than the next closest variant, like a new product launch, wouldn't affect it near as much as the warranty numbers did. And so we raised that visibility of that understanding, which boggled my mind that this, the senior folks and their accounting teams didn't spot that because they had that information too. But it was, so it's not just whether it's reportable or not. It's also an area that if you have decent measures and you're monitoring, not just what you want to monitor, but what you, what gives you the health of the organization or the performance you're doing, which I think objectives and key results might miss because it looks like, to me, that smacks of this is our project and here's the strategy for this project and we're going to go do that. Where if you ignore the counterweights on any change, you do that at your own peril.
Oh, boy. Okay. So when, I would basically say the challenge there was communications and using the right lens. Mm-hmm. Because executives don't understand reliability. They don't understand quality.
No, they understand dollars and market share and you know, what is it, the stock points.
The stock price.
Yeah.
If you'd communicated the 0.5% change in terms of risk and risk appetite, then I think there would have been a more gracious response from them.
Yeah.
So here's my story that is a hard burner for me. Trying to get my product, AI product, into the European market.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you know, it's a decision-making tool. Inputs are unknown. The process quite often in AI is unknown, and the outputs are undecipherable. That's the problem with AI in total. That is where we are in AI land.
Yeah.
Our friends, the bureaucrats in Brussels, are saying, you know, you're going to have a product out there, Greg, and you're going to be, you know, like any safety product, like a heart monitor, you're going to be liable for
the mistakes it makes.
Mistakes, exactly. And then they invented this concept called derivative liability.
That doesn't sound good.
It's horrible. It's been a big debate among a lot of folks in the last year. That basically means that my little product, and we've got two people in our little company,
mm-hmm.
you know, somebody uses it the wrong way in the wrong context in the wrong use case, I'm potentially liable
for the damages caused by it.
Yeah. And that to me as a developer is a liability because, you know, I could basically, if they can demonstrate intent, it becomes a criminal issue. If it basically, because I missed something, it's a civil issue.
But either way, it's difficult for you to get insurance sufficient to cover the potential risk.
That's bingo. So to me, and by the way, a lot of people who develop product think the same way. I'm basically not going to develop product or an AI system, or I'm not going to sell it in the EU market.
Mm-hmm.
Big companies think the same way. They're very risk averse. So I think the two takeaways from the issue are, and I'm going back to field failures.
Mm-hmm.
At what point do field failures become a big issue? Or when do they become a safety issue? When should they be fixed? By whom? And at what point are they reportable? Big issues, by the way, for other discussions.
Well, it is. And it's something that you would imagine. This might be my naivety showing, naiveness or whatever the right word is it would seem in a risk-based organization that part of that process is to say, well, what are the triggers? What are those thresholds? And are we measuring something so we can detect it? Isn't that just part of the basic framework for risk management is what are the risks that we need to be aware of and what do we foresee? Is potential ones, and then how do we know that they're happening or not in a timely way? I thought that was part of the basic risk management framework.
For high-level folks, not for low-level folks, and I come across this every day. I mean, basically leadership, or let's say an executive,
mm-hmm.
focuses on the mission, focuses on the objective, focuses on the risks that inhibit you from reaching your objective.
Yeah.
Then we develop mitigative controls, right?
Right.
To minimize the risks so the objectives can be reached. That's the essence of corporate risk management. For us in the trenches, that's a foreign concept very often.
Well, I want to know, especially for my silo, is like, well, what is the signal that says reliability or warranty expenses is now reportable? I might not understand the reportable thing, grok that completely, but the idea is like, if it goes up 0.1%, do you need to know? When do I signal that this is not looking good?
By the way, that signal becomes the trigger for everything else down the road.
Right.
Happens. Right. Corrective,
But I've rarely had anybody in an organization say, we need to know if it's, you know, this kind of safety stuff or this amount of dollars being spent or this upward trend in the spend rate on warranty or stuff like that. It's usually something I see usually on a Friday afternoon going, oh, I got three phone calls today from different organizations saying they all have these cracked capacitors or whatever the issue was. And this seems to be a systemic or a bigger problem than just a couple of organizations. Let me make a few other phone calls and track it down.
And that's a big problem, because what you just described is reactive management. Yeah. Three phone calls Friday afternoon. I got to jump and do a CAPA, or corrective action, preventive action.
Well, I just need to understand what's going on. Is this three isolated incidents or three major ones pointing to a corporate-wide problem? That was my response.
But we should have had a system that that was on the front end, proactive, preventive, predictive, and preemptive. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Just, you know, anticipate the problem.
Well, that's definitely another subject, because this was on a commodity component. do you do this on everything? I don't think so.
No, you just do it on the key components, you know.
Right. When capacitors, little multi-layer ceramic capacitors are not critical components. They're like, I had one electrical engineer say, I sprinkle them over the board like a salt paper shaker, you know. And then later for cost reduction, I can take them off, claim a couple of us. But anyway, there's more to it. But I think the measures and metrics and the communication up and down the organization, in my point of view, for where I sit, so certainly can improve. I think you're right, though. That might be the title. It depends on where you sit. What you see is depends on where you sit. I think there's room for improvement. That's my take on it.
Well, let's look at the poor executive, right? Because I try to take his or her perspective. If you're giving me problems, why are you needed?
Yeah. Bring me solutions, not problems.
Yeah.
Right, you give me another $1 billion, I'll go fix this for you. I don't think that worked very well. I don't have it. Yeah. But anyway, it's one of those that I'm sure we're going to come back to this a couple of times, but let's see what our audience thinks here is, you know, if you're listening to this, where do you land on measures and metrics and communicating up and down the chain of command or the organization for where risks are and where what triggers are that needs alerts, or how do you prevent stuff from happening? It's a more complicated problem. But are your measures and metrics actually working for your organization? I'd like to hear some success stories. That would be interesting. Let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. You can find a couple of ways to get in touch with us. I actually heard somebody the other day, Greg, saying they meant to leave us a voice message on the SpeakPipe system. And I said, well, do it. It's easy to use. And yeah, just give us a call. We'll write it down ourselves and get it in here. But and you can also find Greg and I and the other hosts of the show on LinkedIn, and our about pages has multiple ways to get in touch with us. So we're certainly available. Would love to hear from you. If you got a question, we'll try to get an answer to you as quick as we can. And we'll probably talk about it on the show. It's so hopefully don't send us any trade secret type stuff. But if you got a problem, you're here to help if we can.
You want me to leave with one final thought?
Sure.
Okay, I'm your boss. If you give me problems, one of us is not needed.
Yeah, the reason I'm not working for you. I knew it. All right, thanks, Greg. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Fred. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.